Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Max Dyer, President and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service. Also joining us from IBM is Maria Paz Barrientos. So, Max, today's government executives face seemingly unprecedented management challenges. In what specific ways does the Partnership's Strategic Advisors to Government Executives, or SAGE program, seek to assist government executives to meet these challenges? And more importantly, to what extent does this effort connect government executives to their predecessors?
Well, one of our goals is really to try to draw together the different sectors in terms of what they have to offer to achieve what's in the common interest, you know, sort of addressing our public sector concerns. And one of the interesting assets I think government has is that anybody who has spent any time in a government job is highly likely to be enormously committed to the success of the enterprise. And it's the Sam Heyman story all over again. You know, when he was a newly minted law graduate, he spent 5 years in government, and 30 years later, if you asked him what was his most meaningful professional experience, he would talk about his time in government. And I think that the power of that experience is, you know, not unique to Sam Heyman, that it's, you know, seen, you know, for virtually everybody who has spent time in government. And therefore, the notion behind the SAGE program is that this, you know, folks that have been in the C-suite, the CIOs, the CFOs, the CHCOs, the CAOs, that they have both a critical knowledge set as well as a passion and commitment to public service that we need to connect back to those, the new folks that are coming into those seats. And again, in an environment in which you have such high velocity of turnover, if you can connect the new team that comes in with those that have been in those seats previously and facilitate the knowledge transfer, you can create all kind of value. And so, again, the partnership is really, I think, a ideal platform for that connection and that bridging of the private sector talent that used to be in the public sector and the public sector talent that's new to their position. And we do everything that includes, we do a boot camp for the new CIOs where we bring, again, a set of experts from both the private sector and also the public sector to help inform, you know, new CIOs about what their challenges are and what opportunities there are for connections to resources, to providing help from finding mentors or, you know, bringing the private sector intelligence to cutting real concern, you know, the big problems that the public sector leadership is trying to address. So if they're looking for input around, you know, what they should be doing, what their, you know, their long-term plans need to be, or a specific issue that they're facing, we can help access the private sector talent in a way that I think is attractive to them. And again, I think, you know, one of the challenges for the relationship is that you know, the federal government is a major buyer of services in the private sector, and managing the contractual relationship in the context of also trying to understand that there are lots of resources out there that aren't defined by that financial transaction is something that we can help both the private sector and government better navigate. So again, our goal is, how do we leverage the resources that are out there? And what we know is that there are a number of folks that are highly knowledgeable, bring a lot of resources to the table, that really want to help. And we're trying to facilitate that relationship.
I mean, facilitating the relationship is important, but you're also looking at transforming the way government works in a sense and influencing the way it works. Yes. So in two ways, particularly given the fiscal realities we live under today, budget cuts and government reorganization, I'd like to sort of delve into your perspective on both. And what I mean by it is, what can be learned from the recent past regarding making smart budget cuts?
Sure. Well, you've done some great research, you know, on the budget cutting side. And one of the conversations we've had is, you know, how the tendency in the private sector among the smart companies is to double down on their investments in their best people because they need them to produce more. Whereas the, you know, the normal reaction in government is the reverse of that. And what they begin to do is cut the training and development dollars that are typically not all that extensive to begin with. You know, one of the things that we've tried to do is to look at what has happened historically when times have been tough, in particular the last government downsizing in the 90s, and examine, you know, what was done right and what was done wrong. And unfortunately, there was a lot that was done wrong more than right. And, you know, one of those top lessons is, you know, don't look at your people as a cost, look at them as an asset, and then recognize that you want to make sure that you get the most out of them, which means that you want to be investing in their skills and their capacities to actually perform. And that is not the normal reaction in the federal environment. You know, other things that I think are critical is the, you know, basic point about making priorities. Again, the frequently utilized mechanism of saving money is an across-the-board cut in the government space, and that penalizes those that, in fact, have been most efficient, and also may mean that you do everything poorly rather than doing a few things very well. And so, again, what we've tried to do is help agencies recognize that some of the more typical responses to tight budgetary environments are not, in fact, the best ones that ought to be pursued. And that's both for the executive audience as well as for the congressional audience. You know, the notion of smart cuts is one that I think is going to be with us for many years to come. We will need to do more with less. The challenge is that the likelihood is we'll have less, and not clear to me that we'll be doing more. The performance side of the equation is often lost, and in part it's a lack of being able to measure it. It's real easy to take money out of a system. You just take it away. Really hard to do it in a way that doesn't diminish actual performance. And when you don't really measure performance well, that becomes even more challenging, and the likelihood that you make bad decisions increases. One of my least favorite examples of this is what you're seeing right now with respect to the, you know, the repeated efforts to squeeze money out of the federal workforce with multiple year pay freezes, with increased requirements on pension contributions, with conversations about all kinds of other ways that money could be drawn away from the federal workforce. And the reality is that there may very well be money to be saved from the federal workforce, but what we don't really understand is what damage we're doing to that same workforce and what the consequences will be. Most importantly, we don't even have a system that is market sensitive. So, you know, the compensation system was set up in 1949, you know, in a time in which you didn't do salary surveys because people weren't moving around. You didn't have a marketplace in the same way for talent. And what we really need to see is, you know, the policymakers saying, okay, here's how we're going to save money, is we're actually going to have a better system of compensation. So we're aligning our compensation with the talent that we actually need. And then we will examine whether there's money to be taken out of the system and understand whether that's going to hurt our ability to get the right talent. It's not being done in the right way, and the consequences are likely to be quite severe.
Max, you've noted that a stronger senior executive service, the SESers, is the single most important thing that can be done to improve government performance. Can you review challenges facing the federal government's leadership core and outline any recommendations that the partnership has for strengthening the federal government's SESs?
Absolutely. There's a lot that could be and should be changed in government. The SES, to me, is a critical cohort because they stand on top of the career, you know, workforce. There are 2 million plus federal workers. There are 7,000 SESers. They survive the political transition. So, you know, if you're going to have an organization that's healthy across the choppy divides of transitions, you need a great SES core. And in 1978, the vision really was of a executive core that was a government-wide asset. They are not today a government-wide asset. They are primarily, or a lot of them, you know, wonderfully talented subject matter experts. 92% come from within government. 4 out of 5 from within the same agency, so they don't have breadth of experience. Only 8% actually move agencies once they become an SES member. And not very many of them come from candidate development programs, so, you know, which are programs that actually have mobility components as part of them. So if you ask me what sort of things ought to change, number one, I'd say we ought to require, you know, for folks going into the SES that they have had a breadth of experience. They should be people who have either worked in multiple sectors or multiple levels of government or multiple agencies. We ought to have a process that enables the federal government to draw not just from internally for the SES, but outside as well. So one push we've had and we've been trying to assist this administration on is to move to a resume-based hiring process for the SES. Again, if we don't create a process that the rest of the talent market can participate in, then clearly they're not going to come inside government. We need to have an office at OMB and with the President's Management Council that is sees itself as part of its responsibility as focusing on that leadership group. So again, I'd ask you who have, you know, great depth of knowledge of, you know, private sector organizations, Can you imagine an organization in which there is just recently, you know, some office that is responsible for leadership and it's in the HR shop, not in the core, you know, executive, you know, programmatic, you know, world? That's a real problem. We really need to match the great talent that we have against the priorities that we have. And the priority side of the equation is really owned by OMB and the President's Management Council. So there are a whole set of things that I think can be done and can be done very quickly and easily to help improve the SES. It's vital that it be done now, both because of the challenges that we've discussed that government is facing, but also because the turnover that's taking place in the SES is huge. You know, 35% are retirement eligible. This is the opportunity to remake the SES into a cadre that we need for tomorrow's challenges.
Sam, you've alluded to the situation we're in with the speed of change, painfulness of change, and the fact of uncertainty abounds. How do you keep a workforce motivated when they're faced with those kind of uncertain situations? And more in particular, would you give any quick tips for motivating the federal workforce?
Well, you can either look at it as a challenge or an opportunity. And in some ways, to me, it defines the kind of people that you want. I mean, we really ought to want in government change agents, people who are agile, who thrive on challenge, who thrive on, you know, multitasking. Or, you know, one of the great, I think, opportunities in government is to work in an environment in which you have to connect to different agencies, to different levels of government. You have to be able to be, you know, the ultimate collaborator. And we've done a little bit of research on, you know, what makes for the most successful public servants, what makes for those Service to America Medals winners. And what we saw was, you know, the ability to collaborate in a highly complex environment was really vital. Also, what was vital was the sense of public stewardship, a commitment to the public good, which is, to me, also actually a quick segue, quite fascinating, because a lot of people who can succeed, you know, one of the critical elements is they're willing to be persistent and to push forward. In the public sector, well, in the private sector, if you run into these barriers, you can always go to another company and say, you know what, they're not treating me in the way that I want. I'll just go to the competitor and, you know, do my great things there. In the public sector, the really amazing achievers are ones that don't give up on their organization, but basically make it work inside that challenging environment. They don't go anywhere else because they know they want to do the public good. There really isn't an alternative. They got to be there to do it. And that is a quality that I think is highly unusual and really quite remarkable. But I think, you know, it's who you select in part. I mean, you can motivate people, but you want to motivate, you know, the right people, and you want to make sure you're selecting the people for whom these are the right things to be motivated by. I think you have to show success. And it comes, you know, from everywhere, from the beginning, from the onboarding. You know, I think it was, and this is dating me a little bit, but NASA would take people to the launch site, you know, when they first arrived and say, you know what, this is why you're here. It's pretty cool. And being able to give people a flavor of why it is that they, what they do really matters. And again, it's the proverbial line of sight, but it's the tangible way of understanding that what you do really matters. And that's very powerful. I think the more you give people a sense of the overall also picture of what's happening, the more knowledge that you can give them, particularly in today's world, you have to do that. And an understanding about how that knowledge fits into a theory of change. That's critical. And you got to recognize good behavior. A new board member of the partnerships is a guy named Doug Conant from who just stepped down from Campbell's. And I love this story. Well, two things he said to me and I think are quite remarkable, one of which is that he said, talking to the partnership staff actually, that 95% of the decisions that are going to be made by your organization are really going to be made without you in the room. And so as a leader, you have to understand that. If you really want those decisions to be made well, you have to make sure your team understands what the objectives are and that they're empowered to actually move forward. The second thing he described personally when asked, again, a question about how much time he spent on talent issues, he said he spent an hour a day over the course of 10 years writing notes, personal handwritten notes, to his employees for great things that they did. And then 10 years later, because he didn't count it up before then, his staff said, you know, we actually did a count on your notes. And the Campbells had 20,000 employees. What they figured out is that he had written 30,000 handwritten notes. And almost anywhere he went, he would find one of his notes pinned up in the cubicle or wherever the office was. They said, and that, again, that's a pretty powerful leadership story and demonstrates also the power of persistence. You do it little bit by little bit, you can have a big impact.
What does the future hold for strengthening workforce and human capital efforts within the federal government? We will ask Max Dyer, President and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.